Freedom is never more than one generation away from extinction. We didn't pass it on to our children in the bloodstream. The only way they can inherit the freedom we have known is if we fight for it, protect it, defend it, and then hand it to them with the well-taught lessons of how they in their lifetime must do the same. And if you and I don't do this, then you and I may well spend our sunset years telling our children and our children's children what it once was like in America when men were free.
Welcome back, everyone, to Patriot Coalition Live. I'm Matthew Nugent.
And I'm Jason Marocek.
Thanks for joining us today. Our goal is to create a timeless resource to teach about the U.S. Constitution and the proper role of government, the importance of America's Judeo-Christian heritage, and how to defend against threats to our republic. Guys, we do this podcast because liberty is important and liberty has a price. Brave men and women sacrificed greatly long before we were alive. Many, many gave the ultimate sacrifice for what liberties we have enjoyed. But leftist people and organizations have usurped our liberties through censorship, canceling, and destroying livelihoods because they don't like dissent and they don't like people who share truths which threaten their power. Today, the biggest threat to sovereignty where we all can make an impact is against what we call the three-headed beast of mainstream media, big tech, and big business. Earlier this year, Google, Apple, Amazon Web Services canceled Parler or stopped giving access to Parler. Last month, Google kicked off their podcast platform, one of the loudest, greatest voices for liberty in America, the Charlie Kirk podcast. It was only for a few days, but Apple still did it. Folks, we still have a voice. We still have power, and we can affect change by where we spend our time, attention, and dollars. That is the reason Jason and I created the free speech alternative to Amazon, which is conservativeeconomy.com. We have thousands and thousands of products you can use every day, which are competitively priced. Last we checked, we have about how many categories, Jason?
Somewhere around 2,200 categories.
It's amazing. Jason's a workhorse, man. He's our tech guy, among other things. So later, we will also be a hub where you can access leading podcasts like ours, as well as many other leading voices in the fight for liberty, and as well as streaming videos and more. It's exciting. Understand this. Every dollar you spend at conservativeeconomy.com rather than at companies like Amazon goes to support freedom-loving companies and this podcast. So will you just do something for us today? Will you please check out the website conservativeeconomy.com? Get comfortable with it. Every time you go to a new store, there is a different place for where you find your products. Same is true with conservativeeconomy.com. We're confident that you will find many great products which you will need and which will enrich your life, because fighting economically is how we fight against a three-headed beast. Some people may say, oh, Amazon is not going to get rich from my socks and underwear I buy from them. That's not the point. First of all, they're beyond rich. Okay. Second, it's not about what they're going to get from it or not. It's about doing all you can to fight for liberty. It does matter. Okay. So, all right. We check out Conservative Economy today for us. We appreciate it, guys. And send us a note. We'd love to hear what you think about Conservative Economy. Freedom at PatriotCoalitionLive.com. That's freedom at PatriotCoalitionLive.com, or any comments you have on the podcast. Okay. Y'all ready to get in the episode?
Yes, sir.
Let's do this. Okay. Title of today's episode is Article 1, Section 8, Limited Powers of Congress, Part 2. And as a review, Article 1 is about the legislature. We're in, last time we talked about Section 7, which talks about how to pass bills, resolutions, and orders in Congress. That was Part 1. Today, we're talking about Article 1, Section 8, Clauses 2 and 3. Last episode, we mentioned we talked about Section 8, too. This is Section 8. Clauses 2 and 3. Last episode, we mentioned that Clause 1 was a carryover from the Articles of Confederation to articulate that the purpose of the taxing authority was to cover the debts that were incurred during the War of Independence and ensure that the same could be done if the need arose in the future. In this episode, we will see that Clause 1 was also a general header for the type of enumerated powers that the framers wrote into the rest of Section 8. Those are, quote, common defense, unquote, and general warfare, quote, unquote. But note that the powers are specified. When you really study this, they're very specific, okay, as we'll see. All right, so now, preface to everything, we're going to go over a lot. We're going to go into detail, and we're going to go over original content here. Now, understand this. We use Johnson's Dictionary from 1785. Is that right, 1785, Jason?
Yeah, I mean, it was written over a long period of time, but 1785 is pretty close, yep.
Okay, so when you're studying the original intent, you have to look at the definitions that were used back then. How we interpret words today is different from how they were originally intended, okay? So if you want to understand the intent, you got to go back to you got to study, okay?
Are you, are you saying that they weren't, the framers weren't as woke as we were?
Unscripted comedy. Oh my God. Woke, man. What asking. Are they going to say about that word? Could you imagine? I mean, George Washington probably has his teeth pulled out and like, I can't believe them. You know, woke. Or Johnson, you know, the Johnson's Dictionary guy, you know, just looking at each other. So anyway, but hey, listen, some of these words, you're going to be like, you know, commerce, trade, you know, what's the difference? Let me tell you, when you're dealing with 335 million Americans and $4 trillion of an economy, the wrong definition of a word and how it's applied either intentionally or unintentionally affects everything about our life. Okay. Jason, you want to take it away?
Yeah, this is true. That's for sure. Yeah. So Article 1, Section 8, again, the enumerated powers, you know, if you've heard me once, you've heard me a million times, you know, if something's unconstitutional, it's likely it's because it's not in accordance with Article 1, Section 8. So we're going to get into clauses 2 and 3 in this episode. And, you know, so like Matt said, we're digging into it. So we're only doing two clauses because there's a lot here, especially the Commerce Clause. So let's get into it. So clause 2 of Article 1, Section 8. And just real quick, as a note, want to just emphasize that Article 1, Section 8, it starts with the Congress shall have power. And then each of the clauses says to do this, to do this, to do this. So when we list a clause, we're going to also put that preface in it to say the Congress shall have power to. Just know that that's five or six words of Article 1, Section 8. So having said that, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 2 says the Congress shall have power to borrow money on the credit of the United States. Mm-hmm. That's it. So it's pretty self-explanatory. We the people granted our Congress the authority to borrow money basically without restriction. But
they ran away with that one, let me tell you.
Yeah, right. But one thing that you will not hear discussed anymore, except probably on this podcast and maybe a couple others, is the predecessor, the proposal, if you will, for this clause during the Constitutional Convention and then the debate surrounding it. So prior to its final form, which I just read to you, the clause said, quote, the Congress shall have power to borrow money and emit bills on the credit of the United States. So what does that mean? To emit bills on the credit of the United States means essentially to print paper money. That basically says that the government owes you the value of the denomination on that bill. Sound familiar? Right. Today we have dollar bills, $5 bills, etc.
You know, a funny story. I remember I was in Washington, D.C., and there was a beggar there. And I gave him I was like giving him a quarter. And it was a few years ago, many years ago, over a decade ago. He didn't even take it. Why? Because when you print dollars, what happens over time? They lose value. And in his case, he wouldn't even take a quarter. It wasn't worth his time to reach out and take it. He looked at me like, who do you think I am? Go figure. True story.
Yeah. Well, and so, you know, the back in those days, right? So you have during this debate, they're proposing, hey, we want to allow Congress to borrow money and emit bills of credit or print money, essentially. One of the delegates, Gouverneur Morris, he chimes in there right away. He's like, yeah, this probably should be struck out, this whole emit bills of credit, because one, if the United States had any credit and had the money to back it up, we wouldn't need to issue bills of credit. But if we don't have the credit, if we don't have the money to back it up, then the bills are worthless anyway. So why are we even putting this in there? I mean, he made a great point. Another delegate, Colonel Mason, he explicitly stated in the Constitutional Convention, he says, unless it were expressed in the Constitution, Congress would not have the power to print money.
And they didn't put it in the Constitution.
No, in fact, Ultimately, the delegates voted against allowing the U.S. government from printing money. There was at that point, there was 11 states represented in the Constitutional Convention. 9 of them voted against allowing the printing of money or emitting bills of credit.
How about that?
Yeah, so it was 9-2. They said, no, we're not going to allow the government to print paper money.
So that's what took place. That's what took place prior to the founding of the Constitution. We printed so many dollars that how does that saying go?
Yeah, it's not worth a constitution. Yeah, continental dollar.
Continental dollar. So,
And even more than that, there's even aside from them voting that down in the Constitutional Convention, there's even specific language in Article 1, Section 10, which we'll get to in a few weeks, which prevents states from making anything but gold or silver legal tender for payments of debt. So if there's a debt to be paid, you cannot pay that with anything except for gold and silver is what the Constitution says, which begs the question. So if there's all these prohibitions against it, why do we have a paper currency today? Mm-hmm. Why have we been printing money? Well, it's a longer story than I'll get into today. It's not the purpose of this episode, but suffice it to say that in about 1870, a court decision, big shocker, said that the Constitution did allow money to be printed. And again, I have no idea, do these people not read the history? Do they not read the context? But that's what we're doing today. And it clearly is in there that they voted specifically against allowing the government to do that. So we'll get into that more in a different episode. Okay, so that was Article 1, Section 8, Clause 2. We can borrow money, we can't print money. So big X mark on that because we're failing that. So Article 1, Section 8, Clause 3, this says, quote, "The Congress shall have power to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes."
Big one here.
Yeah.
This is a big one, guys.
So besides the phrase general welfare, which we will get into ad nauseum, this is one of the greatest sources of abuse in the section of the Constitution as well, mainly due to the misunderstanding of the word commerce, be it willful or through negligence. It doesn't matter. It's still a misunderstanding and misapplication.
Yeah. Let me add something here. For example, we, the central government, have the power to regulate trade between other countries and the United States. That's right. Now watch this. We, the central government, have the power to regulate any commerce and any trade, including what you and your neighbor do in your state.
A little bit of a difference.
Big difference. And by the way, guys, this is, until you get it, it may not make a lot of sense. Thankfully, I have a good friend that ran for Congress. He's going to run again. He's going to win again. But I mean, his understanding of this is incredible. And things you would take for granted, like commerce, what's the big deal? It's a big deal. And when we go over this, you'll be in it, kind of like you'll be empowered with information and understanding, hopefully, and you'll be able to say, hey, it says commerce has to do with, not what you're doing. And we'll go over that in a second, but I think this will be very empowering.
But you got to stick with us, right? Because this is not necessarily just fluff flyover material where, you can kind of just
dig in, folks.
Yeah, we're going to dig in a little bit. So just kind of buckle up a little bit. Okay, so, and by the way, again, we're storming here in the DFW area. So if you see flashes on this side of my face, that's why. I actually can probably throw a rock and hit two houses that have been struck by lightning and have been burned out in this neighborhood and the next one. Anyways, fun stories.
Jesus' name. May you be safe.
Yeah. And if my screen just cuts out, we'll know why. Anyways, okay, so getting back to this concept of the Commerce Clause, which is what we're talking about here. When you hear somebody say the Commerce Clause, it is this clause, which again says the Congress shall have power to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes. So three different situations. So let's start with this. James Madison, he wrote a letter to one of his friends who turned out to be a big influence on the University of Virginia. His name is J.C. Cabell. He, in his letter, Madison said, quote, "Yet it is very certain that the Commerce Clause grew out of the abuse of the power by the importing states in taxing the non-importing states, and was intended as a negative and preventative provision against injustice among the states themselves, rather than as a power to be used for the positive purposes of the general government, meaning our central government, what people refer to as the federal government, in which alone, however, the remedial power could be lodged. So what does this mean? Remember when we started and talked about when the states decided to come together and get rid of the Constitution 1.0 called the Articles of Confederation and say, we need something stronger. Matt made the point that this was basically like a treaty. Before, it was like a treaty of like 13 different nations. Some of them had, you know, treaties with foreign nations. Let's say, yeah, I'm going to trade with Britain and we're going to give them favorable terms. We're going to try to make them steer away from the other states and come to us to do trade. So it's like the states were working against each other, right? So Madison's letter to Cabell is basically stating, look, the importing states, meaning those that were seafaring, that had a lot of trade, like up in the Northeast, were, once they got products, they would charge exorbitant tariffs and fees and import customs to the Southern states and basically make them pay to get these products, right?
Not nice. And that opened the door, if we would have kept the Articles of Confederation, to war and more problems. And you know, England would have come in there and leveraged
driven
that
a wedge.
To their
That's
own.
Exactly,
yes,
right.
Totally.
So what Madison's saying is here is, hey, this Commerce Clause, he wrote this probably three decades after the Constitutional Convention. He's saying this Commerce Clause was intended to get rid of all that, to make sure that they weren't warring with each other and competing with each other, but to put a stop to that. It wasn't an affirmative grant to the central government to do whatever they wanted with commerce. Okay, so that's one way to kind of put this in its context. Mm-hmm. So there's three parts of the Commerce Clause that are at odds to, not at odds, that are being abused profusely today. The first is the definition of the word commerce. The second is the definition of, or at least the use of the word regulate, and how it's used. And the third is what among the several states means. So we're going to talk about each of those, but we're going to start with the definition of the word commerce, because that is what is abused most often. Mm-hmm. Okay, so today, the Commerce Clause, the word commerce, is used as a broad brush to basically justify any sort of bill or regulation that touches on any financial transaction or any production of goods or agriculture, regardless of where it happens or who are the parties. I mean, it is used as a broad brush to affect everything. A couple examples, right? So let's say two friends in the same state are selling a gun to the other one. Again, they're in the same state. Central government has no authority to get involved in that because it's not among the states, which we'll talk about in a second. It's within a state. Another example, let's say that my neighbor who's growing soybeans wants to sell me some soybeans. Got a hankering for soybeans. And they just want to sell it to me. Well, some random farmer who wants to sell vegetables to his neighbor, again, that has nothing to do with the intent of the Commerce Clause. And we're going to talk about that in a second. But those are two examples of things that the central government gets involved in that they should not be getting involved in.
Yeah, and here's another example. It happened last year when President Trump said, he wanted to close certain businesses and he wanted to, enact certain things. And this is when it was used correctly. The state said, no, this is within our purvey. And then he went, okay. And then the states did their own thing. And that's why some states, like in the great state of Florida.
We're loving Texas. You guys more and more these days.
when someone says, why can't you be more like Florida? What? No, Texas is still Texas. We got to harbor Texas. But so that is used. So the central government can't tell stores within a state whether they should be opened or closed. That is the proper use of the Commerce Clause, in the context of what we're saying. But yes, because that's it's proper use.
Right. Yep. So, but this definition meaning that, commerce means anything that touches a financial transaction or pursues a profit, That definition is not supported by the text of the Constitution, nor the context of the debates which resulted in its final language. And it all centers around the definition of the word commerce. And the bottom line is that everything points to the word commerce being defined as trade or an exchange of goods, the physical trade or the physical exchange of goods. Okay.
Yeah. And like I said earlier, you know, commerce back then, or the proper definition, means an individual, a single transaction from one party to another. And the difference is, and it says here among the states, meaning from one state to another, from one country to another, and to the Indians. Okay. So that doesn't mean, okay, what it means is the government should not be getting involved with your state within the state among interactions. Now, what does that mean for us when they're infringing upon our rights within a state? Okay, so the ramifications for this, when you're talking about a $4 trillion economy, 335 million Americans, it's a big difference.
Huge, yep. Yeah, so we're going to get into a little bit of the analysis of why commerce means what we're saying it means based on the textual analysis, the definition at the time, a contemporaneous definition, as well as how it was used in the Constitutional Convention and in the Federalist Papers, which further explained and argued for what was in the Constitution. Okay, so let's start really quick with the textual analysis, meaning I said textual analysis. While the context of Clause 3, it does not provide any sort of self-describing language, it doesn't help us to describe it in that clause itself, other than it excludes certain possible definitions because they don't make sense when you consider that the objects of the Commerce Clause deal with foreign nations and Indian tribes, right? Mm-hmm. So let me read it again, and then I'll tell you what I mean here. So the Congress shall have the power to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes. So if commerce meant production of goods or products like manufacturing or agriculture, how could we, the United States, regulate those things in foreign nations or with the Indian tribes? The answer is we couldn't. So it can't mean that we're regulating the production of goods because it's talking about our relationship with these other countries. We can't do that, right? So that's one reason why that helps us to narrow down the definition of commerce. So it doesn't mean those things. We also can look to how the word is used in other parts of the Constitution. All right. So in Article 1, Section 9, which we'll get to here shortly in probably a couple, two or three weeks, it says, quote, no preference shall be given by any regulation of commerce or revenue to the ports of one state over those of another. So this is what we're talking about before. So two things about this. One is, and again, we'll get into this, talking about, hey, let's not favor one state or the other. So that's the meaning of this. But the important part when it comes to the word commerce is that it uses commerce in opposition to the word revenue, meaning those two things are used separately because they mean different things, right? So it says no preference shall be given by any regulation of commerce or revenue. Well, the word commerce here is used in opposition to the word revenue. So the framers, at least to the framers, commerce did not include any financial transactions that produce revenue. That's what that tells us. So we're excluding anything that deals with, or it can deal with revenue, but that's not what they meant by commerce, right? And the fact that commerce is also used in conjunction with the word ports means that it suggests that the commerce is more about shipping and the movement of goods, right?
There you go.
Okay, so let's briefly, and this won't take long because Johnson was pretty succinct about his definition of commerce. He says commerce is intercourse. It's exchange of one thing for another. It's interchange of anything, trade, or traffic, right? So also very consistent with the definition meaning trade or exchange of goods. And then next, we've got the Constitutional Convention. What did they say about it in there? Now, after doing like an analysis of all the times that the word commerce is used, and there's essentially 50 times, 16 of them happened to be from delegates who are proposing things about commerce, and the other 34 about it happened when there's speeches or debates about it, right? So in those 34 speeches and debates, none of them, the bottom line is none of them unequivocally point to an all-encompassing meaning. In fact, Some of them deal with foreign the exchange with foreign nations, and all of the other ones, they easily substitute trade or exchange as the definition of commerce. Okay, so that's how it was used in the Constitutional Convention. Mm-hmm. And then finally, for this analysis, we're
digging in, folks.
Everyone's still with us.
Yeah, I'll tell you, you could use this at your local town meeting at a. To a state legislator's office who doesn't understand, and who knows, you could run for, you know, state office or U.S. congressman someday or U.S. senator, and these will help you. Jason does a good job at putting these notes together and explain it to me and to us, and I mean earlier we were talking about a letter from Madison to what was the gentleman's name? Coburn,
J.C. Cabell, like
Cabell. Okay. I mean, who writes a letter to somebody about the definition of, is that your kind of pen pal kind of thing? So I'll tell you this right now. If Jason were alive, he'd be saying, Matthew, you know, the reason why, and I'd be like, that's interesting.
Except so, today we do it on PowerPoint presentations on Zoom or something like
that. There
we
go. There we go. So,
but to your point, I mean, it's a team effort. And to Matt's point, you take this, the information that we are discussing and mm-hmm. analyzing and going over and hopefully giving you a better understanding of what's in the Constitution, let's face it. You take the knowledge that you gain in these discussions and you take those to any elected official, and I would almost guarantee you probably 80% more or more of them, you will know more about what is inside the Constitution than they do.
Yeah. And I'll tell you, Jason is a stickler for 100% correct. No.
Yeah.
And I'm telling you guys, this is valuable information. And you might have to listen to this episode, a couple times. But it is empowering. For those of you who have the ambition and the burn and the temperament to serve in the context of political positions, this is empowering. And a lot of podcasts are for entertainment. They're definitely informing, but it would be all that entertainment, all the blessings that we have in this nation would not be able to occur, and it's not standing because so many of us, we lack patriotic education. Jason and I dig into this stuff. And right now it's Monday night after 10 p.m. Eastern time. And we do this for a lot of reasons. One is for personal enrichment. Jason was born with this gene, I think.
It's an acquired taste, I think, some of it.
Acquired. He's done this for 17 years. The guy's a beast, man. And by the way, for military folks, that's the highest compliment, a beast. And but you got to dig in, okay? It is worth it. I've said this in the past. My pastor once told me, the Bible is worth studying your whole life. And so just get in the habit of adding to your bank of knowledge every day. The Constitution too, guys. Okay.
Yeah. And so, and to that point that, we will have, for those of you who maybe there's a lot of information here, this is going to be a great one to go back and look at our show notes.
That's right.
We'll have all these things linked to and the analysis in there for you. So.
And these are original documents, okay? So you can go back and I'm pretty sure I'm positive that you can go back and find them if you want to cross-reference. I dare you. And what you'll do is you'll get smarter and you'll realize you know what they're talking about.
Yeah, I think I mentioned last episode, there's not in some secret treasure trove here in my office where I have all the source documents, right? These are out there for anybody to find if they have a mind to go do it. So let's keep going here. So the last sort of analysis that we'll do is the Federalist Papers, which, as you probably know, is the collection of documents that John Jay, Alexander Hamilton, and James Madison wrote after the Constitutional Convention and during the state conventions to try to convince people why the Constitution mm-hmm. Was the right choice for governing the United States.
Yeah, and, because first they had the Constitutional Convention, then the state delegates had to go back and convince their states. So he was like, hey guys, check this out. You need to understand why we're doing this, why it's important. And it worked.
Yeah. So in these Federalist Papers, I won't go through all these because it does happen quite a bit, but Alexander Hamilton Again, we're talking about the use of the word commerce and what it means or what it meant in those in that time during those conversations. And during in the Federalist Papers, the word is used 63 times. You know, the word commerce is used 63 times, and none of them is it used to infer anything except for the physical trade or exchange of goods. Okay, in Hamilton's in Federalist number 11, he talks about it. He talks about the interchange of their respective productions. Right, so production of goods is not the same as interchange. He talks about the free circulation of commodities. Circulation is not the same as the commodities. There's two separate things, right? In Federalist number 12, he talks about the rivalship between agriculture and commerce. Well, guess what? Those two things aren't the same thing. Commerce is not agriculture or the production of something. In Federalist 17, Hamilton talks about the need to regulate commerce nationally and the supervision of agriculture by local legislation. So not only does he use the word commerce in opposition to agriculture, but he also specifically says that the supervision of agriculture should be done locally. In Federalist 21, he talks about how the causes of the wealth in a nation include, among other things, the nature of the productions, commerce and industry, again using them in opposition to one another. And then, you know, the last one is Hamilton in Federalist 35. He talks about this one's a little bit worded weird, but he says, will not the merchant understand and be disposed to cultivate as far as may be proper the interests of the mechanic, meaning basically someone who works with his hands and builds stuff, and manufacturing arts to which his commerce is so nearly allied. So manufacturing and commerce, two separate things and not the same. And then one that's I thought was interesting too, and Matt's like, yeah, we got to put this one in here too, is in President Washington's term, he tried to use the Commerce Clause to incorporate a national bank. I know he's a hero to many of you, and he was a great, great founder, but even they made mistakes, right? He tried to use the Commerce Clause to incorporate a national bank. Hamilton was the one that reminded him that the Commerce Clause regulated commerce between the states. And so a federal bank, a national bank, is not a good use of that. So, and then, of course, in all the ratifying conventions, there are many uses of the word, basically limiting its meaning to trade or exchange of goods.
Okay. Rock and roll. You would go in deep there. If this is something that you want to dig into, we're going to have a ton of show notes. But in terms of
So basically talking about the word commerce. Matt's now going to talk about, again, going back to the clause itself, commerce among the several states. He's going to talk about the phrase among the several states and to regulate, mm-hmm. to show you what those don't mean and what they do mean.
There we go. So there are still those who mean to abuse this clause that will argue that among the several states includes between one or more in the same states. Okay, if this were the case, then all commerce would be included and there would be no need for limiting the phrase, quote, among the several states, unquote. The only reason to insert the phrase would be to exclude some commerce. So when you hear of an instance where the central government intends to regulate a transaction that wholly occurs within one state, like Jason's, you know, I'm hanging out with him in Texas. He goes, Matt, hey, I've got a gun. You got to check this out. It's extra. I've got 57 others. You know, I don't know how many weapons you have, but I think it's more than
give or take.
And I'd say, sure, if we're in Texas. You know, the government does not need to get in our stuff. Okay.
The central government. Yep.
The central government. They are acting outside the authority that we, the people, granted them. Okay. To regulate, of course, the central government also abuses its power to regulate anything. Now, the power to regulate does not include the power to prohibit. To regulate is to say, if you're going to do this, here is how you must do it. Okay. Regulate in opposition to prohibit. For example, in Article 3, Section 2, quote, in all the other cases before mentioned, the Supreme Court shall have appellate jurisdiction both as to law and fact, with such exceptions and under such regulations as the Congress shall make. Okay, Article 4, Section 3 says...
Really, really quick. So yeah, in that part, Article 3, Section 2, you just read, it talks about with such exceptions and under such regulations. So again, exceptions meaning that it's going to be prohibited, and regulations meaning to be regulated. Those things are used in opposition to one another once again.
Okay. So Article 4, Section 3 reads, the Congress shall have power to dispose of and make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory or other property belonging to the United States. Jason, you want to comment on that?
Yeah, no, same thing here. To dispose of is used in opposition of making needful rules and regulations. So they're not the same thing, to dispose of and make all needful rules and regulations. So to regulate is not to prohibit.
Yeah. So in the Second Amendment, a well-regulated militia does not mean it can be prohibited. Regulate means to made regular or standardized. It could also mean, you know, trained, but you got to understand back then, the proper definition of regulates. Okay, so in the context of threats to our republic, remember that wherever you spend your time, attention, and dollars, you empower. If you spend your dollars with Amazon, you empower Amazon to cancel and censor people with conservative principles and give billions. They give billions of dollars to the enemies of liberty. We're seeing it today, and it seems to be accelerating. And when you shop at freedom-loving businesses like our sponsor, conservativeeconomy.com, you weaken those who mean to do us harm, and you empower freedom-loving companies, and you help us out of this podcast too.
Yep. Well, so let's quickly summarize what we've covered again. We didn't cover too much of the Constitution, but it was extremely important because they were very, you know, the Commerce Clause is a very abused portion of it. So let's just recap really quick. So Clause 2 of Article 1, Section 8 allows the central government to borrow money, but it does not allow them to print money, which was specifically voted against 9-2 in the Constitutional Convention. Clause 3, which is known as the Commerce Clause, we discussed more in depth, is heavily abused based on essentially twisted interpretations of the definitions of the three key phrases, which, you know, the takeaway, and I say the phrases meaning to regulate. What does that mean? It doesn't mean to prohibit. The definition of the word commerce, it means the physical trade or exchange of goods. It doesn't mean anything that has a financial aspect to it or something that's produced, and among the several states. So it doesn't mean that if two people are in one state, you know, they can do what they want. The central government does not need to get involved in that, because among the several states means between states, not within a state, right? So those are the three key phrases that are abused in the Commerce Clause. So the takeaway is that this only allows the central government to get involved in to regulate the trade, the physical trade or exchange of goods between states, between us and the Indian nations, and between us and foreign nations, and does not allow us to regulate production, manufacturing, agriculture, and or even financial transactions. So the takeaway, know your rights, know what can and cannot be regulated by the central government, so that essentially you can call them out when they're doing something that they shouldn't be doing. You recognize it. And the second is, what are you gonna do about it? Well, right now, if you're not in office, you are, I will say, relegated to seeking out your elected official and saying, hey, look, you know, you're using the Commerce Clause to justify this bill or to consider voting on this bill. I'm here to tell you that it is unconstitutional. And in accordance with your oath, you can't violate the Constitution and still maintain your oath to support and defend it. Those two things don't go together. And I expect you to vote against it because it's more regulations, right? More regulations that you're unauthorized to make.
Dare you guys to do that. Find your local congressman, your state legislator, and you'd be surprised. And it takes a lot of guts to reach out to your congressman or congresswoman. It is still called a congresswoman, despite what some people might think and redefine. But hey, great work today, Jason. Guys, if you'd like to support us, please go to patriotcoalitionlive.com/support. It's a big help. Appreciate it. If you're not already a regular subscriber, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, at places like iHeartRadio and Spotify. So thanks, everyone. We dug in deep this time. Thanks for staying with us. We'll see you here next time.
Take care.
Bye now.